Welcome to the fifth episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
Hello, hello.
This week we'll be covering the 1989 film Red Scorpion. It stars Dolph Lundgren, M. Emmett Walsh, and Brian James. And in just a few minutes, we'll be playing back an interview that Dolph did with Justin and I a few weeks back. So, Justin, this was your week. Why did you decide on Red Scorpion?
Are you joking me? I love this movie, man. I first saw this movie when I was fairly younger, and I watched it on Joe Bob Briggs' Drive-In Theater on the Movie Channel. Loved it then. Love it even more today. I've been a huge Dolph fan. Okay, I've been a huge closet Dolph fan for a long time while I was enjoying the parlays of Kubrick and Lynch. Deep down, I really just wanted to watch Masters of the Universe. So, like I said, I'm a huge Dolph fan. I've seen almost everything he's done as an actor. And even though they've been kind of tough, some of them, I've enjoyed everything he's done as a director. Some of the movies he did in the mid to late 80s, especially now, I think, we've talked about this a little bit with geek culture kind of in the mainstream. I think some of the films he did in the 80s are extremely underrated, maybe even overlooked and definitely somewhat forgotten. Showdown in Little Tokyo is one of the greatest movies ever made, I think. It's so crazy. So I love Red Scorpion. Listen to people talk about it. It seems like it has a very love-hate relationship with its audience. Either you love it to death or you hate it.
Yeah, I won't say that I've seen everything that Dolph's done, but I like Dolph Lundgren as an actor, and I like what he's done with his career. And so I was very willing to watch Red Scorpion, and I was very, very happy about it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Before we get into the interview with Dolph, we should probably tell everyone listening, that's not familiar with the film, what it's all about. And I like to have you do that because you just sound better. I sound like I have dicks in my mouth.
So yeah, Dolph plays a Russian soldier who gets sent down to Africa to kill some freedom fighters. And along the way, some things happen where he starts to realize that maybe the way that, he's been treated by his mother country really isn't the best way to be. And he kind of has a change of heart along the way, gets treated badly by some of the people that he thought he could rely on, meets up with a bushman and has a spiritual experience and gets some new shoes, which is probably my favorite part of the entire film, and then comes back and kicks a lot of ass and shoots a lot of people. So it's one of those great 80s films where, they just don't make them like this anymore. It's epic in its feel, but really, it's about killing a whole lot of people and a whole lot of violence, and I really enjoy it for that.
Listen, they never made them like this before. That's the thing. That's what makes it stand out. There is not even, it's done by Joseph Zito, and Zito did Invasion USA and Michigan Action with Chuck Norris, and even, his other films, they don't stand out like this one. It's a hidden gem in the rough, basically.
Yeah, I completely agree. You could compare it to some of the other films from the 80s, some of the, for lack of a better term, body count films that Schwarzenegger was doing, like a Raw Deal or Commando, some of those things. But really, there wasn't any of the real politics behind the actions that Schwarzenegger was taking. There wasn't the bathos behind what Jean-Claude Van Damme was doing. So yeah, Dolph was really kind of going out into new areas as an action hero and really showing a lot, for being the Russian super soldier that he was actually showing a whole lot of emotion. So Justin, let's play some audio from the trailer really quick, and then we can get started with the Dolph interview.
In Rocky IV, he fought for his country.
What the hell is this?
Now, Dolph Lundgren is taking off his gloves and taking on an entire army. One man at a time. Red Scorpion.
The impetus behind the rebellion is this man.
He is your targeted objective.
His one mistake meant a death sentence.
I leave you as an insult to your people. How could you fail?
Their one mistake.
We'll have a band-aid.
You're breaking my bleeding heart, Moose.
Was not finishing the job.
We will deliver our response.
This is the Rebel Army.
Pride of the Soviet Army.
First he was their weapon. Now he's their punishment. They think they control him.
Let's kick some.
Think again.
Doc, you might need some help!
Dolph Lundgren, Red Scorpion.
Okay, we're back. And getting right into it, here's the interview that Mike and I did a couple weeks ago with Dolph Lundgren. Once it's done, we'll be back to talk more about the film.
Now, before we get into Red Scorpion, Dolph, Mike and I are actually really big fans of that clip of you on YouTube. You know, it's that one where you're in a tuxedo on stage singing Elvis Presley's A Little Less Conversation. I wanted to ask if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, it's called the Eurovision Song Contest, and it's like an American Idol over here, and it's a contest all over Europe, and each country has a selection process where they pick out like one song to represent the country. And each year, it's like kind of like the Oscars. It's like they pick like one or a couple of hosts of the event, which is broadcast live, and it goes. It's about seven different broadcasts across the country, and they wanted me to do it last year, 2010. So. You know, the opening show, they wanted to do something special, so we talked about what to do. And obviously, you know, it's about singing and dancing. So, unfortunately, I said yes to doing a little Elvis number and added some drums and ice breaking to it. So I think it turned out okay.
So coming off of Masters of the Universe, how did you get cast or approached to do Red Scorpion?
If I recall, it's a while ago, but they came to me and they had a really cool poster of me looking a bit like Ivan Drago, and I had the, you know, African fighters in the background. They had like Russian choppers and tanks and whatever. It was called Red Scorpion, and it was about a, you know, I read the script, which is quite good, and it's an interesting story by the guy who, you know, basically is sent on a mission, and he changes his mind because he's realizing he's kind of, you know, not doing the right thing morally. So he's torn between, you know, doing his duty as a soldier and his morals. So I thought it was a pretty good story, and you know, then it went through a lot of changes before they started because it was going to be shot in South Africa. And this is during apartheid, so it was difficult to they had a hard time getting distribution and stuff over here, but finally Warner's decided to pick it up, I think, and we went to South Africa. But that's not the end of the story, but that's how it started.
So upon reading the first draft of the script, I was wondering if you could tell us, was there anything different when you read the first draft versus the final shooting script? Wasn't there some sort of alternate opening sequence that had you like training in the snow in Russia?
Yeah, you're right. You know, I got to think back a bit, but I do remember, yes, there was that scene. The film opened with that. It opened with the training in Russia, but I guess for budget reasons, they cut that out. Because, you know, basically had me arriving, I think, straight into Africa. Or if I just started with the briefing, I believe, in the beginning, right? Otherwise, I think there were some changes. The basic story is the same, but I think there were some changing also in the ending. I think it ended a little bit differently, but I can't quite remember what the original ending was. Unfortunately.
In Red Scorpion, you worked with two of my favorite character actors, and I think Justin's too, M. Emmett Walsh and Brian James. What was it like working with them?
Yeah, they were great. Both of them, they're really good in the picture. As a matter of fact, you know, I don't want to watch a lot of my own movies. You know, I'm kind of busy working, and I don't like to watch them anyway, but I think I've caught that picture, you know, like cable or something late at night, and and it does hold up to some extent. It's like, you know, it has a nice feel to it. I mean, it's, you know, the African landscape and all, it looks really good. And those actors stand out. They're very good actors, and it was a pleasure working with them.
Yeah, and on that same note, you know, with Red Scorpion, it's your fourth film. So working with those actors as someone with less experience, do you learn anything by working with those guys?
Yeah, I mean, I always learn from people. But, I mean, yeah, obviously they had much more experience than me. I was still very inexperienced, and I think some of that works for the character because, you know, there's a certain innocence there that you can see behind the hardness of the killer. You see a lot of kind of a boyish quality that works quite well. But yeah, I'm sure I picked up stuff from them, you know, on the set. I remember I was very much into that character. I was, you know, walking around with my AK-47 all the time and practicing taking it apart and putting it together. I mean, I'd already worked on Rocky IV a few years back, where I worked with a Russian director on my character, you know, to sort of create this sort of officer cadet sort of personality. They hold their head a certain way with their chin up, and they have a certain way of carrying themselves. So I was trying to use some of that, if I recall, I was trying to use some of that in, you know, for that character, Red Scorpion.
So what was it like working with the director of Red Scorpion, Joseph Zito?
Zito? Yeah, he was a really interesting guy, very charming and, you know, very, very smart. I mean, I was a kid. I wasn't very smart. I mean, I was basically, you know, tried to, you know, I was very much into playing this character. And you know, I didn't really know half of what I was doing. It was my fourth picture. So was it third or fourth? I think it was third. Well, fourth, if you count, you know, the Bond picture, but really the third, you know, starring role. So I was still learning. And, yeah, he was very helpful, very, very, you know, very experienced guy. And I just remember that they had a lot of problems, as I mentioned a little bit before, because they shot in South Africa, and, you know, they got, you know, thrown out of South Africa by Warner Brothers. They lost distribution. Then they had to go to some other, I think it was Soweto or Swaziland. That didn't work out. And then it was because the king thought, you know, we had more weapons than the army, and they were going to, like, you know, we were going to take over his country or something. He was like some 17-year-old kid. And then, you know, Zito was in all of those meetings. So I remember him kind of more like a producer, actually, than a director, rather. You know, him and Abramoff were kind of running the show down there.
You know, talking some about the controversy the film encountered in pre-production, I was just curious to see, you know, why you chose not to do the press for the film following its release in the U.S.
Yeah, I had a big problem. I think we had a big fight over the editing, and I wasn't happy with the picture. There was a big problem because Warner's, like I said, they pulled out because, look, I don't know all the details. What I know, Warner's pulled out because of apartheid, and then there was some other company took over. There was, I think it was a problem with the cut of the picture. I didn't like the cut, I think, to some extent. And then there was some other problem, some contractual issue that I can't remember if it was something else that I didn't do any press with. But I don't know if it really had a wide release here. I remember I did press with in Japan, and I think I toured in Europe. I can't remember in the U.S. if it had the wide release or not.
So what was it like working with someone like Jack Abramoff on Red Scorpion? I mean, he became very infamous years later.
Well, you know, I had a good time with Jack. He was very nice to me. Took me on a tour of the White House, I remember. Reagan was in there signing some documents. Nice man. I mean, very, very nice to me, very friendly and helpful. And as for all of the business dealings that, you know, happened later, whatever, that I didn't know anything about.
So, you know, first you did Rocky IV, and then you did Red Scorpion. Do you ever get mistaken for a Russian instead of a Swede?
Still do, yeah. Which I guess means I'm doing a good job somewhere. I did a good job in those films. No, I you know, Russians are, you know, fascinating people. They're very, you know, interesting, colorful, and kind of people are scared of them a little bit, and I guess from the Cold War or maybe from the Mafia or whatever. So for some reason, you know, it suits me, and I guess the audience has gotten used to me seeing play Russian, so I don't mind doing it. I mean, there's what, about 150 million of them. So I suppose, you know, somebody's got to play Russian.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into the film business? I heard that Grace Jones was involved.
Well, she kind of inspired me because I started acting when I was, you know, in junior high a little bit, messing around in school plays and all. Then I forgot about it, got into karate and engineering, and then chemical engineering. And then I met Grace, and we were a couple, and, you know, I was doing some modeling in New York, and then I started studying acting because somebody said, hey, you should be in the movies. You look like you could, you know, be in some... I didn't think they had action movies in those days. You could be in the movies. You look tough, whatever. It was just like early 80s. And she was in the Bond picture, and I was on the set one day. So somebody was missing. Somebody didn't show up. And he just said, hey, you want to be in the movie? And I said, I don't know. But you got to stand here in the spot, and you point the gun at Chris Walken. And I said, well, I suppose I could do that, I guess. So I did that, and I basically ended up in the picture. So after that, he said, oh, good work, you know. You didn't screw it up, hit your mark. I said, thank you very much. And then I decided, hey, yeah, maybe I should try this film thing. So then I was studying acting in New York, and you know, I went up for the role in Rocky IV, and that's, I didn't even know it was Rocky IV, but you know, after a lot of work, I got that role and moved to California. So she was kind of instrumental, not sort of twisting Stallone's arm, saying, hey, hire Dolph or I'll kill you, but she was kind of there, you know, inspiring me, or you know, some kind of catalyst to get me into the film business.
So I want to see if you could actually talk a little bit about the stunts you did in the film. Also, I was wondering if you could remember exactly what runs through, you know, like what runs through your mind when you have a bunch of scorpions crawling up your back.
Jesus. Yeah, I did so many crazy stunts in that movie. It's unbelievable. Would never happen today, ever. Nobody would ever, you could never let you do that shit. I did that. They had the scorpions, you know, about 20 of them, whatever it was. And it was at night. It was cold in the desert. And they, you know, they showed me how the stingers were. They'd put some kind of rubber on the stingers or something for them to not to be dangerous. But, you know, I mean, it's, we're talking South Africa and Namibia. So we're not talking like Burbank. So it was a little bit like, oh, okay, whatever. But I was dumb enough to do it, of course. And, did that. I was bit by a hyena, and one scene when the hyena is coming after me, of course, he bites me, right, in the leg, so I have to have the tetanus shots and everything. And I remember the guy, there was a trainer there with a gun. There's somebody here with a gun there. Well, they had security on the set, but I think the trainer, either the hyena guy had a gun or one of the security guys. And I remember I told him, if he bites me one more time, I'm going to get that freaking gun from that guy and shoot him right here. So you better make sure. And the guy was like, I think it was his pet hyena, so he started like, he was like in tears. But I think I meant it because he bit me on the calf. So that was one thing. Then I did this other thing where I jumped from motorcycle to a truck. And I remember I did that stunt from the bike into the truck, or if it was the other way around, I can't remember. I think it was from the bike to the truck, which now you can never do. It would be green screen. You just be on the stage somewhere, you know, and air-conditioned stage. Here was like some dude driving a truck in the road, dirt road, back roads in Namibia. You have to make the jump. So that was crazy. And then did another thing with a explosion, which has also been green screen today, where I go off a trampoline. When the explosion hits, I jump off the trampoline, do a somersault, and go flying in the air. That was real too. Into the water, I can't remember if it was a mat of water or whatever. But anyway, it was a bit hairy. On the first day of shooting, my double broke his neck, for instance, in a car accident, because you had to drive 2.5 hours in sand dunes, and it was like, you know, sand blowing, so you couldn't really see the road. The car overturned, he broke his neck. He survived, but you know, it was just one of those movies where you have to watch your step, really.
So, you know, working on a project that has so much firepower behind it, you know, the timed explosions, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the preparation and training that you, you know, you had to go through basically to put yourself into harm by filming that movie.
Well, you know, those days are quite primitive compared to today because, one, it was, you know, 25 years ago. Two was South Africa, so a lot of the guys were real soldiers. I mean, like, my trainer I mean, my gun instructor actually went off on the weekend and killed some people for real, you know, some terrorists. So he came back and told us a story. They shot some guy who was trying to blow up the pipeline or whatever. So it was a little bit different in that meaning, you know, they had like a more relaxed attitude. So you were actually able to use, you know, full loads, and they blew up all of those huts and everything. And when it's blown up, it's like real dynamite. You can kind of see it. I mean, people were really upset on the crew because, as you'll see in the picture, when something blows up, you don't have a fireball. It just blows up, like in real life. Bang, it's gone, right? It's like dynamite. So the South Africans, the pyro guys who were like from the army, and they didn't know why, they just blew it up for real kind of thing. So it was a little bit edgy, and obviously this is the background, so I was trained in that type of environment. So when I come on a set now, you know, and everybody's like, well, you know, but really careful with the guns and this and that, and hey, you know, the half loads, and that's really going to hurt, and you know, so like put a lot of cutting in your ears. It's a bit different, you know. It's, things have gotten a little softer. But, you know, I did a lot of live firing exercises with the real Sulu scouts. They were like SAS regiments from, you know, the one Rhodesian SAS. So it was pretty thorough training.
Now, Dolph, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what I consider the second act of the film, you know, which it's clearly defined as a three-act movie, you know, the section where your character transitions and you're spending time with Gao the Bushman. You know, what was your experience like working with those authentic Bushman people?
Yeah, I do think the script is quite good. It is a kind of an epic in one way, like those old movies like The Ten Commandments or, you know, not perhaps that good, but, you know, like Spartacus, where, it, you know, the movies, they weren't as quick. People had the patience to sit through, like you said, three acts, and to sort of sit through the Bushman thing and the, you know, the tattooing and the, you know, hunting for boar or whatever it was. But I think, it works, and that's what the film is memorable, because it does feel like you've sat through a real experience, a real story of somebody's changing, not somebody trying to sell you something, you know, like a quick ride. It was like more real. And the Bushman was like a 90-year-old guy who didn't speak English, didn't speak Afrikaans, but he spoke Klik language. He didn't speak Afrikaans. So they had, when Zito directed, he had two interpreters, one from English to Afrikaans, and then the second guy from Afrikaans to Klik. So they speak like that, right? So obviously in Zito's direction, wherever it was, go up there and turn left. Of course, the guy goes and turns right or stops or doesn't go or whatever. So it was quite tedious, but it was a cool experience. Actually, that's the part that I remember the most. Apart from all the problems they had when I was in South Africa for months waiting for the shoot to start, I think what I remember is the, you know, Namibian landscape and the Bushmen, because they actually live there. Believe it or not, still people live out there, and it's like there's nothing there. It's just basically dry and watering, but they managed to survive somehow. So it's pretty cool. And barefoot too. It is actually one of those films that it has a great arc to the character, which is, you know, quite hard to find these days. So I think that was a good picture.
I actually read an interview that you gave back when Red Scorpion was released, and in the interview you discussed your desire to possibly branch out and do some straightforward comedy stuff. And, you know, while you've certainly done, you know, some light action comedy stuff, I was curious to see, you know, if you were given the chance now, you know, would you do a full-out straightforward comedy?
A lot of people always say that. I don't know. It never happened so far, but I don't know why. Maybe it was just because I suppose it'll happen when it happens. Yeah, why not? If it happens, it happens. And if it doesn't, it wasn't meant to. So I'm not going to go looking for it, really. I think, you know, drama with a little bit of comedy, a little bit of, you know, emotion, whatever. Those characters are kind of fun that have a little bit of everything. But, you know, full-blown comedy, I don't know. Could happen, I suppose, at some point. As long as I keep looking young and in good shape, I suppose. If I'm only, Clint Eastwood was my age in 83. So, you know, he's done a few things since, so there you go. I don't know. It could be, I don't think it'll be my, you know, bread and butter, but maybe, you know, fun thing to do once in a while if it happens, you know, why not? You know, right now I'm trying to get some film done as a director, and I'm trying to do a little acting to some fun roles that are colorful, you know, a little bit like Expendables or Street Preacher, where it's, you know, they're dramatic, kind of hard-hitting roles, but they have a bit of, there's a bit of levity, there's a bit of fun there, you know, so I'll take that step to see where it leads.
Imagine this magical unicorn is your online bank account. An action film legend, Dolph Lundgren, is a cyber criminal. Dolph Lundgren wants to take your unicorn and do bad things to it. The unicorn, not knowing any better, thinks about rainbows. Now, you have a choice. Do you allow Dolph Lundgren to manhandle your unicorn, or do you deny it?
Time for some unicorn on the cob.
Protect your unicorn from Dolph Lundgren. Deny digital dangers with Norton Internet Security 2011.
So what was it like all these years later, you know, coming back and working with Sylvester Stallone on The Expendables?
It was interesting. It was a lot of fun. And I feel very grateful for, you know, giving me a shot again and for working with him again. I think he enjoyed it too, because this business is kind of unforgiving to people, and it's just... you know, it's. I think it's unusual that you come together after that long and do something again, and that it works out well, which it did. So I think that was fun for both of us.
Back in the mid '80s, early '90s, people, you know, kind of lumped you in with other action movie stars of the time, like Van Damme and Schwarzenegger. But your career path really diverged from where they went. You know, much more interesting. Can you comment on that?
Well, you know, everybody has their own career arc, and I don't know, I never really had a super ambitious plan, you know, to be like the biggest movie star in the world or politician or I don't know, anything like that. I just kind of went along with it, and you know, did some bigger movies, then I had a family and moved back to Europe, to Spain, as a matter of fact. Spent about 10-15 years there, so I kind of didn't focus so much on the films and the acting. I did some movies, kind of like a living, and then I got into directing about 5 years ago. Started directing a little bit, and that kind of got me excited about the business again. And now I'm back in LA, and moved back to LA, and well, I'm trying to direct and you know, kind of do some more acting work. I'm a little more excited about it again. I guess to sum it up, I suppose I haven't focused as much as some of the other guys, maybe, and maybe I have a slower arc in one way. I don't know, being Swedish or something, I don't know.
So since you've transitioned into directing and writing yourself, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, who are some of your directing influences?
I like Eastwood quite a bit, because that's like a simplicity, and you have to always work with smaller budgets, and you know, and kind of underestimated in some ways. And, you know, a lot of times he never had really famous actors, or, you know, he kind of worked the indie way up into the big league, kind of took him about 20 years or so. But I like him. Well, there are a lot of great directors out there. I mean, Kurosawa, of course, is great, you know, because, you know, but I like... I like Tony Scott too, and you know, some of the stuff he did, like in Man on Fire, and you know, so there's a lot of directors, you know, I like. But I think when you direct, you don't really know your own style. I mean, I never had any formal training, but what happens, you get a lot of questions every day, about 100 questions or 200, and you just answer them the best you can, and then at the end of, you know, 9 months, out plops a movie, and it's like, oh, shit, okay. I guess that was my style then. and you kind of learn slowly. And I've only done about 5 movies, so I think it takes 5 or 10, maybe, you know, if you don't have great formal training, maybe it takes 5 or 10 movies to sort of get your, you know, feet wet a little bit and kind of get your, to get your stride, not to get your feet wet, to get your stride. So, but I suppose, and also I like some of the French directors too, you know, from the 60s and stuff. But it really, sometimes I'll see a movie that I really like that's, you know, maybe some obscure guy, and it's just, you steal or borrow, whatever you want to call it, maybe one or two things from it, you know.
So, Dolph, I got to ask this. What's your favorite movie of all time?
Jesus. That's a tough one. And there's so many. I got a few. Like, I like Unforgiven. You know, the Unforgiven, Eastwood picture, and, you know, because of the theme and the style and kind of rawness of it. And also like The Godfather, you know, because of the acting and the way, you know, the actors get the freedom to work and, you know, wider frames and stuff. And I like, you see the body language. I like that quite a bit. So, but there are a lot of, I like Gladiator too a lot, because that's kind of epic and it's, you know, kind of timeless, and so I suppose these type more epic, you know, The Hero's Quest, I guess some things to do with that. Those movies, I suppose, they stay in my mind a little more, like also Spartacus is one of those too. Like those stories where there's like that arc where somebody has to face with some kind of big choice and have to make that really monumental choice, you know. I like this type of movies. Rocky, the first Rocky is like that too.
You also did that film with John Woo a few years back, Blackjack. I was wondering what your experience was like working with John Woo.
It was really cool. He was a nice guy. I tried to learn a little bit from him too, and, you know, about the cameras and you know, very, very the perfectionist, definitely. It was cool. It was a good experience too.
At this point in your career, do you have a secret list of actors or actresses or even directors that you'd like to work with someday?
Well, look, I haven't had a chance to work with, you know, 99% of all the best directors and actors. I guess it was fun to work with. There's so many great directors, sure. I mean, I think maybe I'm destined to direct my own movies a little bit to, you know, move ahead and move up, or, you know, change my situation. Maybe it's just one of those, it's one of those people. It's just, you know, I know I'm very special because my look and where I come from and my background and the type of films I've done, and, you know, I'm quite different in person than most of the characters I've played. So there's a discrepancy that it's, in one way it's a negative, but it can also be turned to a positive, but you need the right people to do it with, or I have to do it myself. So we'll see how it goes. But there are many people out there who are extremely talented who I'd want to work with, for sure.
So Justin and I are big fans of one of your latest films, Command Performance, where you played a drummer in it. Can you tell me a little bit about when you first started to play the drums?
Oh, I started when I was about 9 or 10 years old, and I did it, you know, marching bands, school bands, that kind of stuff. Then a rock band back in Sweden, and then gave it up for a while, and then only about 3 years ago I directed a picture where I played a drummer, so I got to you know, do it again.
You know, Red Scorpion was just one entry in like a major string of amazing films you did early in your career. I was wondering how important the film Red Scorpion is to you, in the sense that is it an experience and a project for you that could be important to your legacy?
I think it is important. I think it is. It's also a bit of a statement of the times, because of Jackie Abramoff and because of, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union and, you know, the Rocky IV character I played, where Red Scorpion has kind of a place there somehow. You know, I also think that Africa you see there, it's kind of hard to find today when you go down there. And that was shot on location. It was all real. So, and it's a good memory for me as well. It was like one of those films I did when I was young, and you know, it's a typical 80s action movie. So it's like, it's all 80s. So
for me, like I said, I mostly look ahead, but when I look back, that is certainly is a film I remember and fondly so.
So I promised I wouldn't ask you anything about Rocky, but if I don't ask this, I'll probably get in trouble with a lot of people out there listening. So my question is, if there was a rematch between Drago and Rocky, do you think you'd win this time around?
Well, Sly's pretty good shape still, so I did get a little nervous, but I guess I have the height and the reach advantage still. So I suppose I have a good shot, but you never know. He can take a punch.
Okay, we're back. So yeah, Dolph was great to talk to. I couldn't believe how down to earth he was. One thing that folks listening didn't get to hear was that we had a whole lot of technical problems getting Dolph on the phone. And he was a trooper about it, you know, and that kind of the feeling that I had before we called him up was that he was going to be kind of a down to earth guy. And he completely proved that with our conversation. He was just so nice and so genuine.
Yeah, he's really nice. I've actually talked to him a couple times since then. I'm doing an interview with him, big piece for Paracinema that'll come out in a few months, and got really in depth. You know, we talked about Showdown in Little Tokyo. We talked about The Punisher, just about like his coming up in Sweden as a teenager and his interest in martial arts and stuff like that. So it was really cool. You know, going right into the film, God, I love this movie. And I can't tell you enough how much I love this movie. There's a nostalgic factor to it for me because I grew up in a house that didn't look at film as art, but I grew up in a house with a man as a father who worshipped Van Damme, Norris, Clint Eastwood, Schwarzenegger, and Dolph Lundgren. And so when I go back and revisit these movies, they have a nostalgic feeling that brings me back to childhood to a certain extent. And I really love it about him. But also, in the same token, Red Scorpion is an amazing movie. It's very clearly defined in a three-act structure for me, okay? It's got this interesting middle section, okay, which to me, and I'm not comparing it, but it plays out like the opening section of 2001. Not because it's similar in tone or anything, but just the structure of it in the sense that it's these little vignettes. The middle section is with the Bushmen where you see a few minutes and it fades out and it comes back in and it's another vignette and it fades out. It's the same structure and has the same fluidity that with the monkeys at the beginning of 2001, where you see some monkeys, it fades out, you come back into the progression. So it's really interesting. You know, I also think that it's got a very comic book feel to it too. You know, Dolph is extremely superhuman in it. You know, he's throwing guys around like they're mannequins. You know, he's ripping chains out of walls. He lifts Emmett Walsh in a van out of the dirt, out of the mud, out of the, you know, it's about to be hit by a tank. So he's very superhuman. You know, I was just curious to see if you, Mike, had a favorite scene.
Well, I love any scene that Emmett Walsh is in, and Brian James, actually, because they're both two of my favorite character actors. So anything that they're in, even though Emmett Walsh just, it doesn't feel like he's having a good time in this movie. It just seems so cantankerous the whole time. It's like, you know, after a while you want to be like, dude, just give this Russian guy a break, would you? Yeah, he's from Russia and, you know, our mortal enemies with the U.S. and stuff. But just cut the guy a little bit of slack, you know. But now, my favorite bit of the movie, well, the whole thing with Dolph and the Bushman is great. But my favorite shot of the movie is them coming out of the desert. And you get those silhouettes of Dolph and the Bushman next to him. And Dolph looks like he's, you know, five times bigger than this Bushman coming out. And you get the heat haze and everything over it. And it goes on. It's a pretty long shot, you know, both distance and duration. And I loved that. And it was just kind of like him coming out of his haze of all the previous experiences that he's had, you know, to use your 2001 metaphor. It's like he's found the monolith, you know, and he's ready to start breaking some skulls with his weapon. So that was pretty great.
That's awesome that you talk about the monolith.
maybe the sandals are his monolith.
Right. Listen, I totally agree with you. Yeah, the Bushman. See, what thing that makes this, that sets this movie apart is it's got a tremendous amount of heart in it. And, you know, my favorite section is with the Bushman too as well. And there's something in there that just blows my mind. And I know I talked about it in the interview with Dolph, which was that whole scene where you know, him and the guy are coming out of the desert, and they come to the old Bushman's village, and it's wrecked with devastation. And Dolph, being, you know, 6'5" and three times this guy's size, he takes the guy's arm like he's going to hold his hand to escort this poor old man through this carnage because he had helped him. And I think that is something you've never, ever seen in any other action movie of the era or since. And I think it's for sure the highlight of the movie for me. And I think it's what sets it apart and makes it so great.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of heart in this film. And to go back to the interview with Dolph, I mean, I can't believe that Bushman was, what, he said 95 years old? I mean, maybe it's like, it must be clean living because he's really looking pretty good for a 95-year-old.
You hear that, Rich Osmond? No, listen, yeah, I agree. And also an interesting point is I'm not, you know, when they were filming that scene, in order to for that Bushman to agree to be in the scene, his whole tribe followed them around during filming. Like, he wanted his whole tribe present. You know, you mentioned M. Emmett Walsh earlier, but, you know, and I think that his experiences on the film actually reflect the character in the sense that I read an interview with him a while back where he actually went on record as saying that filming Red Scorpion was the worst experience of his career, which is really interesting to me because, according to Dolph, it was magical, you know, so I guess each to his own. But yeah, you know, I also, we talked about the Bushman, but I love the bar scene too.
So you survived.
So?
So move, check bastard.
Broke my fucking nose.
Союз нерушимый республик свободы. Сплотила на веки великая Достроит создание едного рода. Великий, могучий Советский Союз.
Are you out of your mind?
No. Just out of bullets.
Also, you know, another thing I really like in the film is the bizarre, out-of-place use of Little Richard music.
Yes, there is a gratuitous amount of Little Richard music in this. And it's, at least the version I was watching, it was so loud. It was, like, crazy loud. It really reminded me of the scene in Raw Deal with Arnold driving around with Jumpin' Jack Flash playing. But the Little Richard was, I would say, better placed. But to talk a little bit more... The other thing that I liked about the movie a lot was the use of the helicopter and just how this helicopter is kind of like this like specter of death that is following them around. You know, it's like it shows up in strange locations it's like maybe it's following Dolph, maybe it's not. It was kind of like the helicopter from Goodfellas. You know, it's like as Henry's going around the city and he sees this helicopter, but this one was much more ominous. You know, because you definitely saw that helicopter and it was there, and he just kept waiting for it to attack, and it was just really, it was like a vulture up in the sky or something, just, you know, always there. But, you know, and whenever you saw it, you know that something either bad was going to happen or had just happened. So there are echoes within the film of Dolph going in and finding devastation of areas. There wasn't just the Bushman thing. If memory serves, he also saw that, you know, one of the rebel leaders, you know, he goes into his village and it has been torn up as well.
Right. Yeah. I guess we should talk some about the production. The production actually had a tremendous amount of controversy attached to it. Dolph actually, not to discredit anything, but he's actually in the interview, he says at the beginning that Warner Brothers picked up the film for distribution, which is actually not true. He kind of rectifies it later in the interview, but originally what happened was this Warner Brothers was already set to do the distribution. And because of what was going on, because the film was shot in South Africa or near South Africa, and because of what was going on with the apartheid, Warner Brothers actually dropped it because they were scheduled to shoot in this country called Swaziland. And they had brought so much artillery in that the president of Swaziland actually thought that they had more artillery than them. And he was pissed about it. And so they kicked him out of the country. And as you know, that the film was actually, was produced and co-written by Jack Abramoff. And he actually had to lobby. He actually went to Washington, D.C. to lobby his buddies to help them get clearance to shoot in Swaziland. And it didn't never happen. So they end up shooting. They moved the location. I actually can't remember exactly where they moved the location to, but it was more or less a well-known secret that they were aided by company or countries that were pro-apartheid, and so that was the controversy behind it.
So yeah, that was probably the first and last time that Jack Abramoff has gone to Washington and not been able to lobby for something or not get something out of his lobbying efforts. So just so I'm sure that people know this, but I'll say anyway that Jack Abramoff later went on to become a very nefarious character, a whole lot of controversy surrounding him and his a dubious career. I won't belabor the point, though, and I'll let folks go out and check out. There's a documentary called Casino Jack, and there's a fictional film with Kevin Spacey where he plays Abramoff. So, but yeah, he was a very interesting person, or still is a very interesting person. So definitely check that out if you get a chance.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, probably one of the most well-documented controversies in film history about production, because that when, you know, this whole thing went down, the New York Times ran articles about it, and that's what kind of started the flack. And I did look it up, and they actually switched from Swaziland and shot it inside of Namibia. And because Warner Brothers dropped them, and so they ended up getting picked up for distribution. They ended up getting picked up for distribution by Shapiro Glickenhaus, who, you know, worked with Frank Henlotter on some stuff. I think they produced or released Basket Case too. But Abramoff had this huge reputation, and because of the flack, Lundgren, you know, we mentioned the interview, but he didn't do a lot of press, especially didn't do any press in the upon the film's release in the U.S. You know, I think it's really interesting that this film it came just post the end of the Cold War. I think there's a lot of commentary in that too as well. Just that campfire scene where M.M. Walsh is just tearing the fuck, you know, he's just fuck, you know, I'll say fuck if I want to, we swear in America, you know, Russia is shit. And I think that's a whole product of the end of the Cold War thing too. I think there's a huge social statement there too in terms of resentment that Americans felt towards Russians, which is pointless, but it still is there, you know. So I think that's a sign of the times too.
God. Real Cuban delicacies, huh? Man, what'd I give for a bacon cheeseburger right now? Wash it down with an ice cold glass of beer. Fucking A.
When we arrive at Porto Silva, there will be a celebration and much feasting. Beer, too.
Fucking A.
Do the Americans all swear so much as you do?
As a matter of fact, in America, An American can swear whenever, wherever, however much he or she fucking well pleases. A little something we call freedom of speech, which I'm sure you Russians aren't real familiar with.
We are free to swear.
Well, yippee-dee, fuck! Guess I had you bastard figured out totally wrong after all. I'll take the first watch. Shit! Shit, piss. Shit!
Noisy little fuck.
Yeah, I almost wonder if this might have been a little bit too late as far as, you know, was this written before... You know, how much in vogue was it to have Russians as criminals or as antagonists at this point? Because I know it's, you know, there's definitely a shelf life for a lot of movies. You know, like you watch a movie like Miracle Mile, and you realize that it was written way before the wall came down and perestroika and all that kind of stuff. And then when it's released, you know, filmed and released, it's well after that. And so the paranoia of nuclear devastation had kind of gone down. So I wonder if maybe the same thing had happened with Red Scorpion. Was it written before Gorbachev and all of those moves to really kind of end the Cold War?
Well, it was, yeah, I think it was written probably late 86. So it would have been, I think, I don't know, like probably came in the middle of that whole deal. Because you got to think, I wasn't necessarily super old then, but I kind of remember, you know, there's always Gorbachev and Reagan battling it out. So it's probably a product of the Reagan era to a certain extent. Yeah. And, you know, it's really interesting. Another thing I want to point out about the film is there's some really great people that worked on it too, in the sense that Tom Savini did all the special effects stuff on it, in terms of the, you know, like the arm blowing off the guy at the end in the building, and then also you had John Evans working on the third act of the movie, which is the most climactic and loud section with all the explosions. And he actually, coming off of coming to Red Scorpion, he actually came off of Full Metal Jacket for Kubrick as well. So you know, there's a lot of great people working on the film. The film was actually a flop in a sense because of the moves and the issues with the production. It was, the actual budget on the film was $16 million, which is $8 million over the original budget, and domestically it grossed only $4.1 million.
Oh man, yeah. I wasn't trying to tear down the movie by saying that maybe it was a little too late for the Soviets to be bad guys. I know that they have continued to be, or they did continue to be bad guys for a while before the shift was then made to Arabs for a while, and then or Red Chinese or Koreans. You know, it's, we can definitely always tell the era that we're in by our criminals or our antagonists in movies until political correctness is going to wipe out that whole thing and we won't have anyone to fight. So I loved the bit at the end with the arm blowing off. I thought that was a great bit of physical humor, and that was really nice. I was laughing out loud when I saw that.
It really is surprising. It is kind of funny, but it's because there's no other caliber of graphic violence like that. I mean, you see, it's very loud and very violent, but there's nothing that upfront in your face until you get to that part, which is really funny. You know, going back real fast to Abramoff, I just found this really cool bit. I forgot to share with you, which was I read a thing where it says basically that at the time, Abramoff was part of this thing called the IFF, which is the International Freedom Foundation. And the film was actually rumored to be getting money from white South Africa's military. And some wondered that if, you know, how is it possible that Abramoff, being a first-time producer, was able to raise $16 million for a movie? You know, and Abramoff has actually denied that he got the IFF, that the IFF got money from South Africa's military, and he no longer will comment on the film either.
Well, that's a shame, because I think it's definitely a film worth commenting on. You know, it's funny because Detroit has its own ties in with apartheid. You would think that we would be a very anti-apartheid city since we have so many African-Americans here. But our African-American mayor at the time, Coleman Young, was very into giving money to South Africa and exchanging his money, keeping it in Cougarands, buying parts for our pathetic public transportation system from South Africa. So, you know, it was kind of nice that maybe some of Coleman's money was being funneled through South Africa into Red Scorpion. So we could hopefully think that some of our tax dollars helped make this wonderful film. So it's, it, I, really enjoy that this film does represent an era, and it really it's manic with its ultraviolence, and I really appreciate that. I mean, it would be quite a few years before we would see this kind of level of violence on screen again, with things like some of the heroic bloodshed films coming out of Hong Kong. But you know, this really was it's not necessarily even a war film. You know, it would be hard to categorize. I guess you would just put Red Scorpion into the action film category, but there's so much more going on in this film that it's not just a simple shoot 'em up.
Yeah, there's a without reaching. There's a Western theme to it a little bit. I think he's kind of a vigilante, really. I mean, you got to wonder if the motive was really honest, or if he was more interested in taking revenge on his beloved country for scorning him so brutally. You know, I guess. So for interpretation. Also, you know, someone else who worked on the film that was really interesting was this gentleman who was the director of photography on the film, which his name is, and I'm not pronouncing it right, I'm sure, but his name is Jao Fernandez. And what's really interesting about him was he not only did some great camera work, but he was also the guy, his career went back to the 60s, and he shot Deep Throat. He was a DP on Deep Throat. He did The Devil and Mrs. Jones for Damiano, and he also shot all of Doris Wishman's movies. And he also did the bulk of those great Chuck Norris action movies, too, in the 80s.
Yeah, I can see, had this movie been made, you know, 20, 30 years earlier, I could see Clint Eastwood kind of playing this. There is definitely a Western feel to it. And some of the scope reminded me of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. You know, there was just that kind of the way that the story progresses and the way that the characters come back. You know, you have, you know, the Lee Van Cleef character kind of showing up at opportune times. And that was kind of almost like the Brian James character. So there was definitely a better relationship between Clint Eastwood and Eli Wallach than that of Dolph Lundgren and Emmett Walsh. But there were similarities, and I could see, like, this could be translated to a Western very easily. You're totally spot on.
Yep, and, you know, they also, it's really funny to point out, too, that a lot of people don't know, is they actually made a sequel. But as Dolph Lundgren actually declined participation in the sequel, it went straight to video. It was released by Shapiro Glickenhaus, and Abramoff actually produced it. It's aptly called Red Scorpion, and it has completely unrelated storyline from the first one. I think they were just cashing in on the title pretty much, because the film did horrible at the box office, it actually helped aid Dolph's progression into the stardom, you know. But it actually has Jennifer Rubin in it. And to quote Joe Bob Briggs, because Joe Bob Briggs did a review of it, I remember when it came out, and he called it the finest movie about Nazis threatening America with a spear that killed Jesus Christ on the cross ever made.
Nice. Very nice. So that was the spear of Longinus in that? Very nice. I just picked up a book on that recently.
Yeah, so what's interesting, you know, about people that are looking to discover more of Dolph's stuff, that, you know, giving the stream, there's a lot of streaming websites on the internet that actually are offering it free right now. You can check out full versions of Red Scorpion and other Dolph films on, like, websites like Stage Vue and then Crackle, and also YouTube has Red Scorpion broken up into, like, 12 parts. You can watch the entire film for free on YouTube, which is really great.
Yeah, there was Red Scorpion is currently out of print on DVD, but talking to Dolph, it's going to be re-released very soon, and he was even doing an audio commentary on it, so hopefully it'll have the whole shebang of deluxe edition and all that stuff.
Right, it's actually being done through Synapse Films, and to my understanding, there's a commentary, and then also there's going to be a few scenes that were cut from the original film that are back into place.
Oh, awesome. Very nice. So tell us your thoughts about Red Scorpion. Go to www.projection-booth.com and leave us a comment. That brings us to the end of another show. Next week, we'll be covering a rather rare film, a rock and roll pseudo-documentary from 1981, Dead Ringer, and we'll be interviewing the film's director, Alan Nichols. If you haven't seen Dead Ringer, well, you're probably not going to find it pretty easily, but you can go ahead and try to track it down. It's worth your while if you haven't seen it.
Okay. So let's both go down and get some popcorn, and let's head down to our seats, and we'll play you out with Dolph Lundgren singing the Elvis Presley song, A Little Less Conversation. It's from a Swedish television show a few years back that was the equivalent of American Idol, according to Dolph. Look for the clip on YouTube.
And enjoy Dolph's dancing. Bye.
Come on, baby, I'm tired of talking. Grab your coat and let's start walking. Yeah, come on, come on.
Come on, come on. Come on, come on.